The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Isabel Hardman. So we talked a little bit about Afghanistan on the podcast yesterday, but somehow overnight the situation has got even worse. James, what has happened?
So the situation in Afghanistan continues to deteriorate. Last night, the New York Times broke the news that, in a sign of how bad the situation is, that the US has started discussions with the Taliban about how its embassy will be treated if Kabul were to fall to the Taliban. And it is clear now that the Taliban are making even more rapid progress than people expected. We know that there is a US intelligence assessment suggesting that Kabul could be cut off or in danger within a month. And the situation, it is, and we also know that the UK government is sending a small number of troops to Afghanistan to assist with the evacuation of British nationals from Kabul, and with some of those Afghans who have had their asylum claims approved for coming here because of the help that they gave to British forces. The one thing that worries me in particular is obviously there is the broad humanitarian situation, but I also think that there are real questions to be asked about how restrictive the British policy is about who is allowed to come here. You know, it is, you know, one thing to allow, obviously it is right to allow interpreters who've worked with British forces and British diplomats and other Western nations to come to Britain so that they can escape the Taliban. But I also think there is a case for allowing their families to come through too. Their families will be exposed to huge risk if they are left behind. And I think we have a moral obligation to people who took these risks to help us, to help not just them, but also their families.
Isabel, do you think we will see further softening of the British position on this and also a bit more soul-searching about why we withdrew? I mean, we had Ben Wallace this morning saying this.
But, you know, when the United States, as the framework nation, took that decision, the way we were all configured, the way we had gone in, meant that we had to leave as well. And, you know, that is a strategic decision that has been made. It is the case, you know, for 20 years, we effectively bought peace on our streets because Al-Qaeda was unable to launch plots from Afghanistan in the way it had. And we had obviously invested in education and support for the Afghan government. But, you know, I have been pretty blunt about it publicly, and that's quite a rare thing when it comes to the United States decision. But strategically, it causes a lot of problems. And I think as an international community, it's very difficult for what we're seeing today.
So, Isabel, does it mean like the British side is getting cold feet?
Yeah, I think it's interesting to look back over some of the things that Ben Wallace has said over the past few years, actually. So about this time last year, he came up with a very strange criticism of the Labour Party, saying that their illegal wars contributed to the legal mess faced by British troops, which was then hastily clarified and re-clarified by officials in the Ministry of Defence. But I think it's probably fair to conclude that Ben Wallace takes quite a dim view of some of the planning that took place in the run-up to the Afghan and Iraqi invasions and the aftermath of those. So I think if we were going to have a softening of policy towards British interpreters and so on, Ben Wallace would be the most likely defence secretary for that to happen under, because he does seem to be a little bit tortured by the way in which the withdrawal has happened, by the way in which the US have behaved, and by the British responsibility in this as well. He made clear that he would have rather had a different withdrawal scenario, but that British troops couldn't operate in a different way if the US troops went as they have done. So I think this is going to be something that's going to be a lot of pressure from various bits of the Conservative Party and the wider House of Commons as well.
And James, back home, we've got new ONS numbers out today showing the latest COVID situation, and it's looking quite good, is that right?
Well, it's looking flat. So it's still around 1 in 75 people, which is high, have COVID, but that number is not increasing. I mean, there is an interesting question about how much behaviour changes from Monday. Because from Monday, if you're a double jab person and you come into contact with someone who tests positive, what you won't be required to isolate, it'll be recommended that you take a test, but you won't be required to isolate. And I wonder whether that will lead to a bit of an uptick in socializing and the like, because you know it's less risky. I think people right now have been quite often taking a self-denying ordinance because they have a holiday they want to go on or a family event that they want to do. So it's like, we'll hunker down, not see too many people. I wonder whether from the 16th that behavior will change quite significantly. And so I think if you are looking at things that might increase the case rate, there's obviously that change on the 16th, and then there's obviously the return of schools in September, and then later on in the month universities. But I think at the moment it still appears that although the caseload is high, the situation in hospitals with COVID is manageable. But I'll obviously defer to Isabel's expertise on this. But I think one of the other things that is striking is that even though the COVID case numbers in hospital are lower, I think, than that is fair to say, than the government expected it to be, lower than the model suggested, the NHS is still under a huge amount of pressure because of the backlog that it is trying to deal with, the issues of staff absences and staff holiday entitlement. And so I think although the situation at the moment is not concerning, the NHS is still under a level of pressure. But I think the big question is, if you get through the August the 16th changes to the isolation rules, and we still don't see that big spike in cases, it still remains relatively flat, then I think that will be a reminder that we are out of the acute phase of this situation.
Well, James, on that, before we came on air, you were mentioning that government seems to have changed its mind on reaching herd immunity. What's been the latest mutterings about that? Are we still hoping for herd immunity?
I don't mean the government has changed its mind. I think that the scientists appear to have subtly changed their view. I mean, previously, the unspoken UK policy was herd immunity through vaccination. What you've seen in Evidence House Commons to an all-party parliamentary group this week is a senior figures on the JCVI saying, essentially, you're not going to get conventional herd immunity because the virus will mutate in a way so that it can to give it a better chance of spreading among vaccinated people. But what the vaccines will mean is that this will be far milder disease than it would have been. And so you will not get the number of kind of hospitalizations and deaths that you would get in an unvaccinated population. And I think this is another sign that we are kind of shifting to having to learn how to live with COVID, how to manage the situation, rather than aiming for a policy where kind of herd immunity essentially makes it go away. I think you are going to end up in a situation where, I think one of the scientists this week was talking about how you may well see lots of people get COVID over the next year or two, but without it having a particularly acute effect on their health. And I think this is going to have significance because it is a change in how you manage the disease. I also think it has implications for countries such as Australia and New Zealand that have pursued a zero COVID strategy. I think the Australian strategy was, you know, Scott Morrison, the Australian Prime Minister, has said that they would open up the country once they achieved a vaccination rate of 80%. I think in the hope that that would have essentially mean that COVID couldn't get going there at all. I think this, now they're obviously going to have a far smaller wave in terms of hospitalizations and deaths than unvaccinated countries had back in March 2020. But I think this fact suggests they will still have some sort of wave when they open up.
And Isabel, in the other big news of today, Westminster Council's deputy leader has resigned after the Marble Arch Mound turned out to be a deep failure. Isabel, for people who don't know what the Marble Arch Mound is, can you just take us all the way back to the beginning of the saga and tell us how we got to this stage?
With great pleasure. So the Marble Arch Mound is a strange plot by Westminster City Council to try to attract visitors back to the West End after COVID. And from the outset, some very wise people like me, thought that this would be a really bad idea because essentially, even in the lovely, stylish architect's drawings, it appeared to be a large mound of earth deposited right in front of Marble Arch with a staircase going up it. And apparently this was going to be the thing that was going to attract people back to the West End, as opposed to the world-class shopping venues, the cultural attractions, the theatres and so on. No, actually, people just wanted to walk up a large heap of soil. I live in West Lothian in Scotland, which is famous in part for its bings, which are large heaps of shale left over from the mining industry, which they're enormous, and slowly nature has reclaimed them with birch trees and other scrubs slowly growing up on these large spoil tips. The Marble Arch Mound, which has cost £6 million, looks like one of these bings, which are waste products. Now, I mean, in West Lothian, people are quite proud of the bings and they're a sort of cultural thing. But I've never heard a proposal to export the success of the bings from West Lothian to West London and to try to repeat their success, whatever that is, in the UK's capital city. When it opened, it turned out that people didn't want to pay the ticket price of going up this mound of earth to look at what actually wasn't the sweeping views of London, but quite a limited view because it's not actually that big. And that actually they were slightly mystified as to why they should pay to go up a mound with some trees that had been dumped on it, not particularly mature trees, mostly, as I say, birch trees like the ones that that you see on the bings. But the ones on the bings are alive, whereas these ones appear to be dying already, which is quite an achievement. When right next to Marble Arch is Hyde Park, which is free and really beautiful and has lots of mature trees in it. Therefore, a green space already attracting people to this part of London. And the reason I get quite aerated about this, as well as it just being funny, is that it's an example of how messed up our attitude to nature is, that we think we can just dig up a load of soil, which is a living structure, not just something to be sort of thrown around like laundry, and deposit it somewhere with some trees, which again are living organisms, and then dig them up again and move them somewhere else when they've served their purpose. On top of that, it's something that I'm also obsessed with, which is an example of bizarre political failure and a lack of planning and scrutiny, where politicians say that something must be done, and then the something that they come up with, in this instance, a bing, a large pile of earth, is the only solution to the West End's economic woes. I mean, you've got a quote from Rachel Robithan, who is the council leader, saying, "Doing nothing was never an option. The mound may delight or divide views, and that's okay, but we're confident that in the end it will fulfil its original brief to get people back into the West End." I mean, I suppose it might do that in a bit like those Santaland attractions that end up being in the Daily Mail with a sort of drunk Santa and reindeer that are dying or on the verge of starvation in some slightly miserable part of Berkshire, that actually people might turn up to laugh at the Marble Arch Mound, and therefore the West End will fill up with people who are very happy at this ridiculous monument to human stupidity. But there does need to be an inquiry into how Westminster City Council managed to plough ahead with this bizarre plan in the first place, when it seemed perfectly obvious that a number of much smaller, more modest schemes would probably have helped the shops and the cultural attractions of the West End a little bit more.
Well, this is also the council that's refusing to pedestrianise Soho and Oxford Street, right? I mean, it seems like to me that those things would be stimulating economic growth a bit more.
Yes. Exactly.
There is also the fact, isn't there, that the West End isn't going to come back in the way it was until international travel and tourism resume. You know, I mean, the huge number of people who were in the West End shopping, enjoying the attractions, were tourists. And so I think in some ways, the Marble Arch Mound was a kind of, obviously a folly, and not as beautiful as many follies, for all the reasons that Isabel set out. But I also think it's premature. I think until international travel resumes in a relatively normal manner, then you won't be able to tell what the true situation in the West End is.
James and Isabel, thanks very much. And to hear more on Afghanistan, you can also listen to our Saturday Shots that's coming out tomorrow, where James and Isabel speak to General Richard Barons. He helped to establish the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan from 2001 and has spent a lot of time there in the last two decades. So do join us again for that one. And thanks for listening.